You're listening to another episode of the Oral Torah series from the Talking Torah Roundtable Discussions with Yoel Halevi and Jeff Gilbert. For more episodes, you can reach Jeff at talkingtorah.org and visit us at hebrewinisrael.net.
Okay, Barakim Ben Ibrahim, everybody, we're so happy with us again for another one of our weekly discussions that we haven't had for a month and a half with Yoel Halevi. So, hey, Yoel, how are you? It's been a long time.
It's been quite a while, and I'm actually very glad I'm back because yes. It's something that I've been doing for several years, and it was gone for a while. So it felt a little strange that I wasn't recording with you, but, you know, I was doing other things as
myself.
Well. Yeah, it was like this feeling of like, I want to go back to my normal life. I mean, this past, for me at the moment, everything works based on semesters. This past semester has been very, very interesting. And done a very interesting course that I took that's not over yet because I still have an exam to take. And people can pray for that exam to go well because this is not an easy class. I mean, it's been kind of like a vacation type of thing lately, where I've only been doing work with my students and not really doing anything other than that. And, you know, as a student of mine / friend said to me last night, you know, it's good sometimes to go back to the old and familiar and just, you know, feel as if you've gone back to normal life.
Yeah.
I'm very glad that we're back, and I'm very glad that we're able to get back on track here, because people have been asking, you know, why are we stopped? Because we've done so many episodes, some people going like, okay, so maybe they're done, but we're not, because our plan was to build up all the way to more or less the present day.
Right.
And especially talk about, you know, very practical and real things, not just theoretical principles of what's going on, but actually detailed discussions about oral Torah, written Torah, and the relationship between them. And, you know, there's going to be a very interesting turn point that might actually explain some of the things that go on with me in modern days and the reaction towards oral Torah in modern days and the buildup of Jewish academics and so on. Because I had someone write on my Facebook page last week that my Facebook page is a Karaite website. And I was like, no, you are confusing the difference between Karaites, which are one thing, versus, you know, Jewish people who are academics and are thinkers and are critical about things that we do in the Jewish world. And I always say this to people, I'm not standing in the authority of being a rabbi or anything like that. I'm standing in the position of a critic, of a person who lives this world, understands a lot of the things which are going on in this world in current days, but also from the point of being an academic, of being a person who is not an academic, just someone who reads books, but actually someone who's undergoing training, and also a person who was heavily involved for many years, for over a decade, in the study of oral Torah in different schools and with different schools of thought as well. And trying to explain this, because people will stand up and they look at all these different things which are going on, and if you don't have an understanding of how historically this all came to be, you actually don't have an understanding of what's going on today and what the discussions are. And I actually surprised several people when I turned around and I said, no, I think oral Torah is a real thing. It's just not what you think it is. And I can produce many, many, many academics who completely agree with this. And that's where I come from. And one of the reasons I say I don't come from a religious point of view is because religiosity is a very, very, very dangerous thing. And it lacks a certain rationale that I have a problem with.
There's several people that I've run into over the last couple of years outside of a primarily religious context. They were people who were more academics. You were one of them, you know, several years back, 3-4 years ago now. And over the last several years, 2 years, I guess, I've met others. And I do see two really distinct groups of Orthodox. I'm sure there's more, but the two distinct groups are those that are very convert-centric and very religious in their ways of acting and thinking. And then there's an academic group, which is that way as well, but from a traditional sense, because that's their community. However, they have beliefs that expand much greater in depth and breadth than what they would be doing if they were focusing primarily on the more religious aspects. But they're both considered orthodox because they maintain the traditional views and they maintain the traditional lifestyles. However, their thinking is outside of that box. And I definitely put you into that camp. And I find those people quite refreshing. I left a world of religion and a lot of discussions trying to build people up towards a religious perspective. And it's refreshing not to really be inundated constantly with that kind of, context.
Well, religiosity, first of all, the word religion is strongly misunderstood by a lot of people. So I keep on seeing these posts, like, for example, Judaism is not a religion. First of all, it is. That's actually nonsense. It is. The term religion is a Latin term, which meant something which is the difference between religion and superstition. So it is a religion.
Right.
It's just people don't understand what this term actually means. But the thing is that if you're a religious, which means you're uber traditional, you're not open to asking questions, which is, by the way, I think the exact opposite of many of the rabbis that I've had to study their words and their personalities throughout the years. And questioning and raising questions has always been the side of what Judaism really was. And the, Jews were, for example, were some of the first skeptics in the world, which means not skeptics in the negative sense, but skeptic in the positive sense of looking around and saying, okay, so you have the statue here and you invented the statue and you modeled the statue by your own imagination. And now you think that's a god. That doesn't make any sense. And the Jews were the first one, the Israelites were the first ones to actually question this. Now, I specifically have to say Jews because it became more persistent, this mockery of idol worshiping, more in what we call the Jewish era of Torah keeping. Because if you remember, we have the Israelites, which is basically First Temple, but then we have the Judeans inside this entire structure of Israelites. We also have the Judeans, which were relatively distinct in comparison to the northern tribes. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing, when people talk about, what does it mean to be a Jew, the history of Judaism really begins in the First Temple period. In historical studies of the First Temple era, we hear about the difference between the Judeans, which were an isolated group that lived in the mountains, versus the northern tribes of Israel, which were, more in contact with the rest of the world because they had access to the sea, they had access to certain trade routes, and the Judeans were kind of isolated. And this is, by the way, one of the things that gave them a lot of strength.
Israel is kind of the buffer from the world and the world mindset.
Exactly, and this is why Judea was the one that was able to maintain the Torah keeping more strongly in comparison to, say, the northern tribes. You think about Ephraim and Menashe that were still in the mountains, but Ephraim and Menashe, when they came down from the mountains, which, by the way, if you climb Mount Kermel, you can actually see the mountains of Menashe. That's how small the country is. They had almost immediate access to the ocean because all they have to do is travel through several valleys on flat land, pass through the area I live in, and just there, well, behold, you're in a bay. And the history of Judaism really begins there. So it's not that Judaism is some kind of rabbinic invention. But what's very important to understand is that criticism is a major part of the Bible and is a major part of Jewish thinking in overall. And the problem is that there's always going to be people, and this is more of a psychological thing, there are always going to be people who are trying to romanticize history and try to develop this very, the only word I can use here is an orthodox point of view about what was originally done. And this is something which is very, very consistent. And On the other hand, we have the people who are innovators, and they try to present things and do something new, and there's always a clash between these two elements, because on the one hand, an innovator is a person who's trying to deal with the reality in the now, versus a person who's trying to romanticize the past. But then on the other hand, the person who's trying to preserve the past,
right,
is a person that might be preserving something very, very real that's actually crucial for the existence of Judaism or Torah keeping, versus someone who's trying to innovate and they're actually undermining the constructs of how this thing is practiced. So it's
kind of like
very
the dichotomy of from the wind and the anchor. The wind is always pulling and the anchor is always pulling, and they're always keeping each other in one place, and they're always fighting.
Exactly. I think that's a very, 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 very good example. So one of the things that comes up, and I think this is going to be a very pivotal point for this series, is this question of authority. You know, as a person who's been around in a lot of places, as my friend said to me yesterday, come to think about it, Yoel, you've been in more places and of thought, I mean, basically with different groups around Israel, than most people that we know. And they said that they actually admire that about me, because it gives me a very, very broad perspective about how Judaism is practiced. Now, unlike, for example, some academics, where a lot of things are theoretical, and this theoretical academics is a very, very dangerous thing. It's what's sometimes called armchair academics,
sure,
where you just
all
read
wind
about something.
And no anchor.
Yeah. And the thing is that I spent several years studying here and several years studying there, and I was in that community, and I was in this place and that place. And I really gathered a lot of information throughout the years. And what's very interesting is to see these different groups and these different people with their different mindsets, and also some people that don't know anything and they walk around thinking they know everything. I had an incident 2 weeks ago where a rabbi published a very, very strange article, and I wrote, this is clearly a mistake and there's something wrong. And then this young man writes to me, he says, oh, you should learn halakha. And I wrote back to him a very, very long comment with all the details of the halakha needed to explain why this rabbi is wrong. Because I knew exactly what I was talking about. This is the thing. This is the big plus about my experience. I've learned throughout the years how to access information better than most people, especially inside Jewish religious circles. And the broadness of what I learned throughout the decade and a half that I was basically going around the entire country learning in different places gave me a very, very good and very broad perspective of things. And this is what I say. When I talk about authority in Judaism, I am speaking out of actual practical knowledge. So there was a whole discussion then, and someone actually was there when the rabbi spoke, because apparently this was a transcript of something that he spoke about in a class that he gave, and someone stepped in and said, oh, by the way, I was actually there. And what he meant was he gave an explanation. I was like, I went back and said, thank you. You're proving what I'm trying to say here, that there's something very, very strange in what this rabbi said, because I knew exactly what principle he was referring to, but I would have never known this principle if I would never come in contact with a certain individual that I had many discussions with. So there are a lot of things about authority, and I think this is the biggest, most complex issue in the history of Torah keeping from day one. And we're actually coming close to this parasha. You actually start with Korach. Korach turns around and says, I undermine the authority of Moses. All the congregation is holy. We should all be able to serve in the temple.
Yeah, who made you boss?
And he turns around to Moses and says, who made you boss? Now, the thing is that Korach wasn't lying about what he said. Korach was saying something very, very true, but he was manipulating and changing details to make it sound as if he is the authority. And Korach is what we can call armchair academics, because he has all these theoretical bits and pieces. Remember, he's a Levite, and he has all these theoretical bits and pieces versus Moses, who's the one who actually is speaking with God. And this, the story of Korach, by the way, is used throughout Midrashim, when people talk about authority, is used to try to defeat their rivals, their halachic rivals, if I may call it like that, to say that they're the ones who are right. And this argument carries on. For example, about 4 years ago, I think it was 3 years ago, I can't remember exactly, no, it was about 3 or 4 years ago, I did this little program called Jeroboam and His Mistake, where I spoke about the fact that Jeroboam as well, he stepped in and with some logical arguments tried to flip everything over and say, listen, really, we don't really need to go listen to King David. We don't really need to listen to that, to anyone from there. We're just going to develop our own calendar, which is based on what we have here in the Galilee. And there's always been this theory that Jeroboam basically changed the calendar because he was living up north. And in the north, the barley ripens later, so therefore everything moves by a month almost all the time. But in Judea, they said, oh, he's celebrating on the eighth month. I think that that argument is very, very reasonable, though obviously theoretical, but it seems to be very, very reasonable. And calendar has always been historically one of these big focal points of argument, because he controls the calendar, yeah. Controls the temple, controls the taxation, controls a lot of aspects of people's lives. And, you know, they control the cultic calendar, cultic meaning religious calendar. They control when things are done in the temple. And this is why, for example, you have the Lunar Sabbath people, because they want to be able to control the calendar even to the level of the week, where they tell you the week is really like this and that. By the way, there are several very interesting papers which were produced throughout the years regarding this discussion about is there really a connection between the lunar cycle and the Sabbath? And overall, by the way, most academics say that there is literally no connection whatsoever. It's a feeble attempt by certain academics to undermine the Bible as a unique book. And I always tell Lunar Sabbath people, I tell them, listen, it's a very interesting attempt what you're doing, and we admire your will to return to something, to the original. But unfortunately for you, in this specific case, there's no evidence whatsoever anywhere of this. Even the very interesting manipulations which are done to verses to try for it to come out as if the sabbatical, the Lunar Sabbath is real. At the end of the day, the people who came up with this idea from the beginning, at the source of all of this, are academics that try to say, oh, the origins of the Bible are in Babylon. And there's actually a very interesting paper called, Bible and Babel, which is a response to, written by something, Finkelstein, not Israel Finkelstein, the famous archaeologist, but another Finkelstein, who explained the mentality and the philosophy behind some academics back in the late 1800s and early 1900s. So again, it's another thing about authority. You know, someone steps in and comes up with an idea, and they are authoritative because they are some of the most leading academics, but they're also trying to be innovators, and they actually come up with an idea that they try to really desperately prove, and some people follow in and some people don't, creating more splits in Torah keeping world. So it's very important to understand that authority stems from several things. And I think that the first thing that a lot of people try to play off, so if we start breaking this down, there are, three points of authority that we can speak about. There's prophetic authority, where someone is a direct mouth of God and therefore has the power to determine right from wrong through prophetic power, where God speaks to them and tells them. That's, for example, Moses and anyone who was discovered as a real prophet. That's always a very, very problematic place. And then we have, and I'll explain why in a moment, then we have the priestly Levitical authority, which are people who were given down the Torah itself and are probably the main authority in Torah keeping, which means the main authority, the hierarchy actually is that priests and Levites are actually above a prophet. A prophet is a balancer, but the Levites and priests are really above everyone else, which means if someone walks up to a Levite and says, I by power of prophecy tell you that you're wrong, the Levite can look at him and go like, okay, and your point is. And then the third pillar of authority is what we call tradition, which means it's really in the hands of everyone. You sometimes, if you're not too sure what to do, you just look at what everyone else does. And these were the three pillars of authority in biblical Israel. Now, when I say about prophets, the problem with prophets is as follows. There were plenty of false prophets, and I think the best example is Jeremiah. And prophetic power, this is something a lot of people don't understand. Prophetic power was actually something people could use. Yes.
Just to verify, did you say Jeremiah was a false prophet?
No, I said Jeremiah is a very interesting example of dealing with false prophets.
Oh, okay. Whew. Okay. Just want to make sure I was tracking. Okay, go ahead, please.
Because Jeremiah is the prophet that we actually hear a direct conflict between him being a true prophet versus several other false prophets which are mentioned. Hananiah bin Azul being one of them, for example. The problem with prophetic power is that there are liars. And there are people who are also delusional, people who are convinced that they're prophets and so on. And this is why the Torah, especially in Deuteronomy, gives authority to prophets, if you go to the chapters that deal with that, only in the area of, you know, what is God's will now, in the now, basically. Like, for example, Elisha saying, okay, you have to go in, you have to chop those trees, you have to block the water fountains and everything. Instructions like that. But instructions from a prophet are considered to be a type of Torah. And we hear in several verses, I think it's in Isaiah, he goes over and he says over and over again, my commandments, he uses the word Torah there, which really means my instructions and mishpatim and so on. So we do hear that prophets had some kind of an authority, but their authority was more to say, what is the direct will of God in a certain situation?
They were pragmatic.
Or at a specific time. Not pragmatic. I wouldn't say the word is pragmatic. I would say that their job was the check and balances of reality. Mm-hmm. They would go in and say, when other mechanisms fail, they're the last resort that steps in and says, okay, we're going to tell you what you're supposed to do. So prophets are, and the thing is that in a lot of circles today, and especially circles which are not Jewish circles, not traditional Jewish circles, prophecy is overpumped. And people go in and they believe that they have some kind of prophetic power. And even if they do, their authority is not in that place. Their authority is only when something goes completely haywire. And they might believe that that things have gone bad, they have gone south, but there's no actual evidence of this. And I'm about to step into the two other types of authority. So I'm not going to go to priests and Levites yet because a lot more complex. Then we have tradition. Now, a lot of people think the word tradition is a dirty word. And the thing is that tradition actually, as we've explained in the earlier parts of this discussion, traditions are the living, breathing keeping of Torah. Because the priests and Levites are in the temple, they pass down certain types of knowledge, they can maintain the Torah as a written script, they have practices that they memorize. But at the end of the day, the average Shmo who lives in a village somewhere in the mountains or wherever or the valleys, and he wakes up in the morning and goes out, he's the one actually keeping Torah. So he saw his father do such and such, and he doesn't have a copy of the Torah. Unlike the fantasy a lot of people believe in, the number of copies of Torah was probably very, 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 I can't say the word, it's very small, to a level there might have been just a handful of copies or maybe several dozen copies. I'm taking two. It wouldn't be more than several dozen. And though it's been proven that Israelites, and especially Judeans towards the second half of the second temple were very literate, there's no evidence that they actually had copies of the Torah. For example, in rabbinic circles, there's this understanding, there's a commandment that every man should have a copy of the Torah at home. But in fact, no one's ever actually lived by that. Even the most extreme rabbis, many of them never even had a copy of the Torah. This is, again, the very theoretical principles that exist in rabbinic Judaism, but we're not there yet. We've been talking about it, but we're not there, but we're going to come to authority. And so the average person will be the one who is the real living, breathing Torah and is the one that actually makes the everyday life decisions. You don't run to a Kohen or a Levite every 5 minutes. You kind of know what you're doing. So, for example, if we go back to the Lunar Sabbath for a second, they knew when Shabbat is. They knew that there's a cycle. They knew that there's a weekly cycle and so on. Everyone kept Shabbat more or less at the same time. Actually, not more or less. Everyone kept Shabbat at the same time because these were things that everyone knew. And that's another part of authority, and I'm going to be skipping ahead into the future in a moment. And then we have the Kohanim and the Levim, the people who sit in the temple, the people who are the protectors of Torah, the small group that was chosen to be the teachers of the people. And that goes together, by the way, with the king. And they were the, what we could call the pragmatic, the people who have to make decisions on, you know, what do we do in a situation that's never been presented before? What do we do with, rulings that are unusual? What do we do with general rulings? And what do we know that was done before us and so on? So they work off of a little bit of partially tradition, partially knowing what the written Torah is, and things like that. And they were the first person you go to, if anything fails. So really prophetic power, as I said earlier, only steps in when there's a need. When there's no need, you don't hear prophets at all. And, or there, they might be there and they're the people, these men of God, and they're more spiritualist than anything else. It's not, the history of prophecy is a little bit more complex than what people think, because it seems to be there were thousands of people who were prophets, but they were of different kinds. There were people who were, preacher prophets who would go around and tell people what to do and not do, and there were prophets who were more what we call king's courts prophets, were more advisors to the king, and there were people who were just holy men and women that had a connection to the divine, and they were there to give people everyday guidance, to give them certain spirituality that the priests and Levites can't really give them because they're more in the practical world, and you know, esoteric ideas have always existed. And,
can you give us an example of that? I mean, most of the people who are listening to this are going to come out of a Christian background, and all of the hierarchy that is people facing all have some type of a spiritual interaction with their, you know, people. How would that actually have worked in those days?
We don't know enough. It's not as if we have like external literature. Everything that we have about biblical times from the world of the Israelites is mostly from the Bible. And we have a few glimpses here and there about the work of prophets, but more at wartime. Like, for example, there's a letter from Lachish that indicates that there's this prophet who's weakening the hands of the people, and we only have the end of his name. So there's a debate if it's really Uriyahu, who was a prophet that had to run away to Egypt, or is it maybe Yirmiyahu? We only have the Yahu at the end of his name, so we can't really know what it is.
It's just some Yahu.
No, but that's basically what the writer of the letter, by the way, was saying, more or less. But with less cheekiness and actually being a bit more serious. Now, there's this prophet here who's telling everyone, you know, surrender to the enemy. And we have a few glimpses here and there, but really everything that we know about this area is really what the Bible lets us know. And the Bible is sometimes very skingy on information,
Well, let me throw the second part of this out and then I'll give it back to you. The reason I ask was because it seems to be from what the stories I read in the Bible, there was very little interaction unless there were offerings being brought to that level of the Levite.
Their
primary interaction was really with the judges.
So, first of all, you need to remember that any written information is always going to be very limited to the will of the writer.
Sure.
Which means what you're seeing there is maybe just a very small piece of the entire thing. And now, the judges, who are the judges? You know, you barely hear of any judges except for the book of Judges. The judge becomes the king. You never hear about any hierarchy or structure of judicial systems at the time. You don't hear it, so you can assume there's nothing there. It's like a lot of things that happen in the Bible that you really don't hear almost anything, and then people walk around with this thing, this was the only thing that existed, which is 100% untrue. As an historian, we know as a fact that when we receive a certain piece of information from whatever document or text or whatever it might be, that we always assume that there's probably more going on that we just don't know.
It's not happening in a vacuum, right?
Yeah, so the statement you just gave is again what we call a religious statement of assuming that what you have in front of you, and I'm not trying to put you down, just saying.
No, it's a good point.
this is the kind of treatment you have to deal with, where people just read something and they say, oh, this is the only thing. They basically block everything that might exist. So we know there were judicial systems. We know that everything was highly organized and so on. So it's very dangerous to say what you just said there. What we do here is, you know, when the Bible has an agenda, it's trying to tell you a story, or what we actually call a narrative, that presents things in a very, very specific way. And therefore, you only get to hear what the writers wanted you to hear, because there's a point they're trying to make about keeping Torah. There's a point they're trying to make about what was going on and where we made mistakes to try to avoid them in the future. So there's a very, very specific agenda of the Bible, especially the historical writings, and therefore you only get a very partial picture of what was going on. And this is when people say, I only follow the Tanakh, it's like, okay, so you only want to follow one very specific point of reference in Torah keeping, instead of trying to expand your mind a little bit more. So what I was basically trying to say about the whole thing is that the clash between these different parts of authority is something that we basically see throughout time. And, for example, prophets were being undermined in the Persian era, basically, the beginning of the Second Temple, because a lot of people felt that the prophets, failed them in different areas. And we actually hear some subtle criticism against prophets in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, for example. And this actually might be the trigger, by the way, that might have caused prophecy to die out, that God basically said, okay, they don't want to listen to prophets at all, and now they're using some other mechanisms to argue against them, and prophecy was basically shut down.
Well, he got up and left.
That's your argument.
Yes,
that's
it is.
That's something that you claim, that I strongly disagree with.
Really? I'd love to discuss that with you sometime. I mean, because Ezekiel 10 does seem to be kind of specific.
Yes, but when you say he left, you're sounding more like as if he's completely abandoned.
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah, Leviticus 26, he would not abrogate his covenant. No, absolutely not. Never, ever. But he left the temple.
Well, again, to what degree did he come back or not? There are several things here, because you hear Haggai, and Haggai says, you know, it is the time to rebuild the temple. So there was this will to come back. We need to discuss this some other time.
Yes, we do. Yeah, it's a whole different discussion.
But,
whole full discussion.
Yeah, but basically we have a massive problem, because you interjected in the middle. I forgot what was the thing I was actually saying before you stepped in earlier. The thing is that we hear a few examples of what prophets did. Like, for example, we have the whole story with Elisha, that the woman, the Shunammite woman that has a child, and when she goes, the servant says to her, it's not a new moon, lo chodesh v'lo shabbat, it's not a new moon or a Sabbath, which means people probably went to the prophets for some spiritual guidance on times which you consider to be holy days. Was a new moon a holy day? It's an interesting question by itself. We don't know 100%. But we also hear, for example, schools of prophets. These were people who prophesy. And for example, we have Shmuel, with his school of prophets, that when Shaul comes in contact with them, he starts prophesying as well. But this is not receiving prophecy like, for example, the prophets of writing, or even Amos. And Amos is a very interesting interaction as well. Amos being the check and balances of the priesthood, he goes around to the priest of Bethel and says to him, you know, you're not doing it right. So he turns around and says, no, go to Judea and eat bread there and prophesy to them. There's a very interesting clash there between the priests and the prophets. But that's why I said the prophets are like this final line that they draw in the sand, and they say, you know, if you're going to cross this point, you're going to be on the other side of God. And but we hear, for example, about Shaul, and he's prophesying, and he's not prophesying in that sense. He goes into like this meditative state, and maybe even a certain level of maybe even madness. So there were these spiritual holy men, almost, if I may borrow the term, very, very, very loosely, shaman-like type of people.
I'm following you.
That they are, you know, more spiritual guidance than actually Torah guidance. Now, the Kohanim, become the authority in the Second Temple, and the high priest becomes the authority. He almost gets almost kingly authority as well. But and we're kind of tracking back on things we spoke about earlier, but we need to build this up to understand what was going on. And the Kohanim become this authority to a point where some of the Greco-Roman writers say that Jews are governed by their priests. There's no king, there's no prophets or anything. And the problem was that at the time, a lot of Jews also had their own traditions about how they do things. And we slowly hear of this school of thought of people who study the Torah. They have traditions and they become the zealots and the, or not necessarily the zealots, but the scribes. And they are people who deal mostly with, you know, with the traditions and the written Torah. And the written Torah is no longer just in the hand of the priests. There are other people who are able to read it. And this might be the beginning of what we know as rabbis. And what we hear by the time, by the end of the Second Temple, we hear about two authorities, main authorities that were struggling with one another, the priesthood versus the rabbis, if we can call them rabbis by this point. And they were struggling over authority as well. Now, when the temple was destroyed, the priesthood kind of died out. But the problem was that the rabbis, because they didn't belong to any specific institution, were also individuals. So when the temple was destroyed, the priesthood was dispersed. And I know I jumped ahead hundreds of years forward, but there's a lot of details we don't know in between. There, when I was studying this stuff.
For the listeners who have ADHD, they followed you just fine. No, go ahead.
Well, I am married to someone who has ADD, so I'm used to having to do stuff like this. So the thing is that we don't know enough about the in-between time. We only have like little glimpses. There are these little bits and pieces that we try to paste together to make sense, and we don't know enough. But at one point, this school known as the Pharisees, and which are the forerunners of the sages and the rabbis, emerge suddenly. The priests, it's easier to track them. It's the Pharisees that's a bit more difficult, and the other groups that develop, the other sects or cults. The problem is that we don't know where they emerge from, but it seems to be that they emerge from the people. As a counter reaction to something the priests were doing, because a lot of the priests were going and were running around with these Greeks, and
well,
there were people
you're talking about the Sadducees versus the Pharisees, right? Because the Pharisees are more people focused, right?
Well, I'm not going to go into those details because we've covered some of this,
right.
But they emerge, but they also emerge as individuals. And that's where the problem begins. So when the temple's destroyed, the Romans reestablished some kind of governing structure in Judea, beginning with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who presumably did or did not turn around to the Romans and say, give me Yavne, because there was also Lod at the time. Lida, which was a very important center as well. But anyhow, we reach a point where there's this thing known as the princehood. And the princehood, as it's depicted in Judaism, is this all-powerful. Everyone accepted the authority. There might have been some arguments and so on, but it was as if this, you know, they had the image of the Sanhedrin suddenly comes out at that time. That's really when the Sanhedrin began. There was no, the Sanhedrin is a very, very vague concept, historically speaking, in Second Temple history. It is, it isn't, how permanent it was, how much power they actually had. There's a lot of questions which are unsolved about this. But the overall understanding in academics is that the Sanhedrin really started showing up after the Second Temple. And that's when, for about 200-300 years, the Sanhedrin was an actual active body. But the problem was because there was no center, and it's actually a system that developed out of individuals agreeing to work together. No one wanted to give up their individual authority and their individual traditions. So when people say, you know, everything is from Moses on Mount Sinai, there's a problem with that, because we actually know as a fact that many of these rabbis worked as individuals. So where does this statement come from? This is actually a statement that was said as a compromise, that instead of saying there's only one person with the one true opinion, rabbis agreed to disagree. And it came out with this term known as 70 faces to the Torah, meaning 70 different opinions, 70 being a topological number of everyone because there are 70 nations. And, you know, everything is from Moses, from Mount Sinai, Elu Velu Divrei Elohim Chaim, and so on. These are all words of the living God. These were all statements which are completely misunderstood in Jewish circles today, and even Messianic circles and so on, misunderstanding what the point was. The people did not want to give up their individual authority. So they came to this understanding that they agreed to disagree, and those were the type of statements used. But at the end of the day, and this is something I remember when I presented this to a yeshiva student, he was very surprised. He actually, it took him several days to even comprehend what I was talking about, that rabbis were individuals, and they had individual opinions, and they acted upon these individual opinions, and they sometimes strongly disagreed with one another to a point where they even have open arguments with one another. There actually is no such thing as absolute authority and absolute opinion in Judaism. It never was, and it probably never will be. And this
reality—that's a statement not often heard by most people that we see on Facebook.
And because I'm saying this out of a very, very specific point of view, but I'm saying this as a person who's also a former yeshiva student, an active academic, and a person just has life experience. But that's the thing. Why can this exist? Why does this exist? It's because we understand that we don't have a prophet that can tell us where we went wrong. And therefore, for the sake of respecting other traditions and respecting people's opinions, we allow these differences to exist and treat them as if they're all true and equal, because there is no way of proving or disproving any of the opinions. So it's a mechanism of coping with one another, because at the end of the day, if we don't, that will be the end of the Jewish people. And this is something, this was the struggle when Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, then after him, Rabban Gamliel II, who was the grandson of the famous Rabban Gamliel from the New Testament, when they realized Judaism has to survive, the Jewish people have to survive, they were willing to compromise opinions and ideas to gather all these different rabbis together to make sure the people survive. But they also knew you can't take away, because this person, this rabbi who's a student of another rabbi and goes back several hundred years, you can't tell him that he's wrong, because he has his tradition, he has his knowledge of how things were kept. And then you have another one. So they had to compromise somewhere. And this compromise is what enabled the Jewish people to survive throughout the years. So Jews in general, for many, 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 many years, were able to argue, fiercely argue with one another, and still live with a certain element of unity. So when I see, for example, arguments on Facebook, and I see people from the same camp or people from the same place of thought, the emotional side of it is already a Western problem, but you see people who come from the same group, and they always create splinter groups because I disagreed with him over some practice that we have, and now I think, and they go off into their own future. And Judaism kind of said, no, we're going to allow opinions here, because at the end of the day, none of us have the real power of prophecy that we can tell us where that final line telling us where we went wrong. And we always hope that one day a true man of God will show up and tell us, okay, here is really what you're supposed to do. And we'd be perfectly fine with that. And it's an interesting oxymoron, because in the end of the Second Temple, the rabbis say decreeing against prophecy, saying a rabbi is better than a prophet. But there's a historical reason for that, because they were battling false prophets at the time as well. There were plenty of people at the end of the Second Temple claiming they were prophets and trying to tell everyone how to keep Torah. And these were actually some of the leaders of the sectarian groups, such, for example, maybe some of the Qumran people, which are mentioned in the scrolls. But in any case, the pluralism that Judaism allows when it comes to opinions, as long as these opinions work off a very specific set of rules, is very open. So, for example, when I hear a Reformed Jew talk about the pluralism of Judaism and the possibility of many opinions, they're actually abusing that principle. You actually have to have not only knowledge of Torah, but you also have to have a very clear tradition of where you come from. Reformed Judaism exploits certain loopholes inside Judaism to try to prove itself real and true, but it actually doesn't realize, or maybe does realize and prefers to ignore, that you actually have to have certain things exist simultaneously for you to be able to have an opinion. You can't just poof appear out of nowhere and say, "Oh, I have an opinion, therefore it's valid." No, 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 no. You have to have very extensive knowledge of Jewish texts. You have to have a very extensive knowledge of Jewish tradition, and you also have to learn from someone. You can't be a self-ordained rabbi, which is, by the way, in my opinion, most Reformed rabbis are self-ordained. They no longer belong to the chain of Jewish tradition. They're reinventing things. And, you know, I understand the place of a Reformed rabbi when it comes to leading his community as a community leader. That's perfectly fine. But when it comes to the authority of what Torah actually says, I would never listen to any of them because, you know, I say this regardless of where I come from as an Orthodox Jew, I just wouldn't listen to them because I know that their knowledge stems from a very, very specific place, which I don't think is really what it originally was. And I don't really have to use examples, and the tantrum here is not about the reform movement. I'm putting a tantrum because some people might think it is. But going back into Torah-keeping Judaism, more traditional Judaism, the problem was that we all saw people spread out all over the place, everywhere. And, you know, there are Jews in the East, and there are Jews in North Africa, and Jews in Europe, and then at one point Jews in America, and everyone's everywhere, and it's very, very, very difficult to even communicate your opinions with one another. So Judaism today allows a lot of traditions and a lot of practices, a lot of things, because we understand that people are individuals. We understand that people came from a lot of different places, that some of them were not even connected to other communities. And it's very, very difficult to tell people change your tradition and change your opinion because I have an opinion. So now we're jumping ahead because we've covered a lot of this material and we've spoken about these individual rabbis that were dealing with the Talmud, that were dealing with these opinions of individual rabbis as well. And we reach the 15th century, 15th, 16th century. And there were several things going on at the time. First of all, the most important part here for this discussion is the creation of the Shulchan Aruch. We
now
spoke
you're
about.
You have to explain that to some of the folks.
I'm going to explain everything.
Beautiful.
You remember the Rambam, Maimonides. He wrote a massive book called the Yad HaZakah, which is the 14. Yad is means 14. Yud 10, Dalet 4, 14. 14 books that were put into one book, where he tries to deal with every aspect of Judaism, including things which are not practical Judaism, Torah keeping for today, like temple service and everything. And he tried to deduct all this information from different sources, including the Babylonian Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, and other sources as well. And he said that there was a letter where he wrote that he regrets the fact that he did not write down his sources, which I think is very true. It was a mistake. But, you know, he was willing to accept the authority also of the Jerusalem Talmud, which is something that's unheard of today. There's, for example, a rabbi that I know him personally, who tries to practice everything, or tries as much as he can to go according to Jerusalem Talmud, because he says, we live in the land of Israel, the traditions of the land of Israel is what prevail, and he tries to live according to Jerusalem Talmud. And, which, by the way, his logic there is actually quite solid. And, and he was willing to use all these different sources. But together with him, there were many other rabbis out there who were trying to interpret the Talmud after different stages. We spoke about the Amoraim, the Tanaim, the Amoraim, 2nd century, 4th century, 5th century, and then we have the Geonites, and then we have the Rishonim, and we only touched about only a few of the Rishonim. But what Maimonides did, which is very interesting, and then about a generation after him, someone else tried to do something very similar, he tried to create some kind of unified code of conduct that's detached from the Talmud, and is not part of the Talmudic discussion, but only the conclusions. And after him came the Baal HaTurim, which I can't remember his name now, but he was I think the son of the grandson of the Rosh, which we mentioned, Rabbeinu Asher, and the Baal HaTurim did something very, very, very similar to what Maimonides did, but this was more of a European, Western European tradition. But when we go, what they opened up is this, these attempts to create books of law or code of law, which are not Talmudic discussions. Now, several hundred years down the road, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who also, if I remember correctly, lived in the land of Israel part of his life, tried to create a unified book. He tried to create a book that would take several principles, and you can read the introduction to the Shulchan Aruch, where he explains what he did. And he realized, and he sounds a little bit like Maimonides sometimes, he realized that there's too much debate and people don't know what to do. So he, being the head of the rabbis in the land of Israel, and being he was basically that generation of people that were expelled from Spain or their children, and he might actually have been from Spain itself. I don't remember his full biography, but as one of the senior rabbis in the land of Israel, he decided that there's a need for a new code book. And he wanted to write something which will bring all of Israel together under one law, under one code. And he wrote the Shulchan Aruch. But the Shulchan Aruch, first of all, there are a few things about it. First of all, it doesn't cover every aspect of Torah keeping. It only deals with the real practical things that people have to live by to this very day, meaning excluding temple service, excluding any criminal law that ends up with execution and things like that, anything that we don't really practice today because of different variant reasons. But what he tried to do was create this like unified book for everyone. Now, to do this, what he did is he said, I'm going to use three pillars of halakha, which is Maimonides, which represents Spanish Jews and part of North African Jews, the Rif, Rabbi Yitzhak Elfasi, who represents what we can basically kind of call the Babylonian or Eastern tradition, and the Rosh, which presumably represents European tradition, which, by the way, none of that is, by the way, true. Maimonides represented himself, and Rabbi Yitzhak Elfasi represented himself and some other rabbis, and the Rosh represented part of the tradition in Europe. But he tried to find some kind of a compromise in between and try to create something that will be acceptable to everyone. In truth, by the way, he didn't just limit himself to the Rif Rosh and the Rambam. He goes to a lot of different places, a lot of different teachers, and sometimes he even ignores everyone else. Takes this one rabbi and works with him. Like, for example, in the Laws of Nedarim, I think it's I think it's Yoreh De'ah Reshu Daled, Yoreh De'ah Rule 214, where he actually makes a complete decision, a decision which is completely contrary to 90%+ of the rabbis, and he goes only with the Ran. A lot of different examples there, but he really, really attempted to do this. So we have that. And I'm not going to go into the biography of Rabbi Yosef Karo, you can look that online. We step for a moment into Europe. What was going on in Europe at the time was the beginning of the great study halls. And the great study halls, what we call today yeshivot, were places that people would come from sometimes great distances to study under famous rabbis. And in Europe at the time, the tradition, and this is very different than the East and North Africa, the tradition was to continue everything that was done from around the first century, which means you have a Talmud, you have traditions, and you discuss them. Any rabbi that wants to make a halachic decision doesn't go to a source book doesn't go to some redacted information book. He actually goes into the Talmud, he goes into the discussions about the Talmud, and he makes a decision on the spot. And there, the practice in Europe was to go according to halacha kebatrai. The term was halacha kebatrai, which means the halacha, the law, is according to the las, which means us when we live. Which meant that though we have all these ancient traditions and these ancient rabbis who made decisions, at the end of the day, each generation has its own teachers and they have to make decisions. Now, this is an interesting paradox, because on the one hand, it's an innovation, because each rabbi and each generation has to presume kind of like reinvent halacha, not exactly, but kind of. But then on the other hand, they're keeping to a very, very old tradition that said that the authority of making decisions is through a very, very specific way of studying. And the way the yeshivot originally worked was that if you had a rabbi and you learned and that you're under your rabbi, your training was to study tractates of the Talmud and then have real discussions about the Talmud itself with the different commentators that you have. And the training was to actually know how to do these things in reality. So what do I mean by this? If I take an example from academics, you can read someone's book about this inscription or actually read the inscription and use your deductive powers to understand what's being said there.
Right.
If I take, for example, anything like that. So do you want to be reading through someone else's eyes or do you want to be reading the actual source itself?
You can be your own commentator or read from another commentator.
Exactly. So, for example, you know, you can use a commentator for a direction. And this is kind of like what they were doing, it seems to be. That they were, at the end of the day, the decision wasn't based on, I am quoting Rabbi so-and-so who lived 200-300 years ago, and I'm just telling you what he said. No. I studied the subject, I looked at this, and the answers, every time they would give an answer, it would be much more complex. They would discuss the Talmud, they would explain how they got to this conclusion. And they, and that's how things were decided, and they had to, he had to know the Talmud, and he had to know the sources, and he had to know the commentary. But then, in time, there was this argument known as the argument over the pilpul. Pilpul is when you kind of like uber discuss information. You're trying to kind of try over analyze it and super break it down and so on to really mostly sharpen your mind. And because there were teachers who wanted just for the students to sharpen their minds, students started losing knowledge of traditions. They started losing knowledge of what's actually being said. And there were two rabbis who stood up against this, the Maharal and the Maharshal. The Maharal, by the way, is the famous rabbi, Moreno Arav Rabbi Luria, his name was Levin, not Luria. Luria was someone else. Basically the Maharal of Prague, which is the famous rabbi who, and if you remember, this is kind of outside of the scope of history that I usually study. But his name was Levin, something Levin. I really have to look up some of these details. But this is like hundreds of years forward from the type of material I usually work. Actually, over 1,000 years off the type of material I usually study for my work. But the Maharal was a traditionalist and he openly attacked this and he was very, 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 very against. I can't say how against he was. And the Maharshal as well, was very, very against as well. And they were two pillars of rabbis. And they were considered to be some of the greatest authorities in Europe at their time. They openly attacked this, but there were too many people who were overly excited about the idea of this new way of learning. And there were rabbis who were trying to promote how smart they were. And I'm not trying to be demeaning. It's just basically how it's depicted in their writings, how the Maharal, for example, writes about it. That he says that they're so intent on chidudin, on sharpening their mind, that they actually don't have any knowledge. They don't actually have information. They just have bits of information. It's like, for example, a person taking a sunan bit in the Bible, they choose a chapter in the Bible, and they're studying, they've spent their entire life to studying this one piece to its words and meaning and everything, but they know absolutely nothing about the rest of the Bible, which means they don't really have a picture of what the Bible is. They only have this little piece there.
Right,
they're big experts in what they're doing, but they literally have no practical knowledge. So they were both attacking this. And then suddenly the Shulchan Aruch comes into existence. Now, at the time of the Shulchan Aruch, there was a younger student of the Maharal and the Maharshal, known as Zahama, Rabbi Moshe Iserlish. Now, his name everyone knows and everyone remembers, and I'm actually a relative of the Rama through a cousin. I have a cousin who's a direct descendant of the Rama.
Wow.
And Rabbi Moshe Isserlish was working on a very similar book at the same time the Shulchan Aruch was being written. And the moment the Shulchan Aruch came out, and he had the same intent, he wanted unity. So when the Shulchan Aruch came out, it came out probably several months or years before he was actually done with his book. So he kind of put his book away and didn't tell anyone about it. And then the Shulchan Aruch started spreading. But what it did, there were two things that happened here. The first thing that it did was, oh, there's this great rabbi from Israel, or from back then, whatever, Greater Syria, who wrote this book about halakha. We no longer need to know the Talmud. Kind of like what the Rambam was doing. One of the reasons the Rambam got into very hot water was the fact that he detached from studying the Talmud, which was against what most people were doing, especially in Europe. In Europe, they were very, very against the Rambam, against Maimonides. And what happened was that it weakened the mind of the students, and it made it even easier for rabbis who wanted to promote this new pilpul type of study, which, by the way, originally was the minor part of the study, because what they did originally was they had a little bit of pilpul in Europe. Pilpul sounds like a pilpul, like pepper, trying to sharpen something, make it feel sharp. And then there was a whole thing known as the chilukim, which was even a crazier way of studying. And there was a big, big fight about that one, even bigger than the argument over the pilpul. And by the way, it's called pilpul. It's supposed to be called pilpul, but it doesn't matter. It has to do with accents. But in any case, so when I say pilpul, I mean the same thing as pilpul. I'm just flowing back into my regular jargon of speech when I explain these things in Hebrew. So.
And you're speaking to mostly Americans. To them, to us, it sounds the same. Pilpul or pilpul? No,
yeah, but some people might hear this and they say, oh, the accents are different. Is he still referring to the same thing? So I have to clarify that.
Okay.
So basically what happened was the Shulchan Aruch started spreading. And as I said, two things happened. One was, hey, we have the Shulchan Aruch now. We don't need to study any more large pieces of information. We can just, you know, focus on these little details that we're trying to train people to sharpen their mind, and there's no actual practical study. And then the other thing that happened was the Ramah, the Rabbi Moshe Isserlish, received a copy of the Shulchan Aruch. Wait. This is undermining our traditions as European Jews. So he wrote the book known as the Mapah. So what is the Shulchan Aruch? Just to explain the names. Shulchan Aruch means the set table. Shulchan is table, Aruch is set. So it's as if there's a set table with a prepared meal that all you have to do is sit down and eat. And then the Rama said, oh, I am going to write my tablecloth. I'm going to add something to this. And really, when you open Shulchan Aruch, the core of the text is the writings of the Rabbi Yosef Karo, and then immediately after, in smaller letters, usually that's how most of the prints work, the words of the Rama, where he disagrees with him. And there are many places where he disagrees. So really, we really have two Shulchan Aruchs in our hands, the one from the Rabbi Yosef Karo and the one from Europe. But even with the Rama writing his book, there were still plenty of rabbis who said, listen, you know, this is the Rama's opinion. And the Rama was mostly trying to put down the traditions that he knew of and maybe some understandings that he had. And he was really trying to represent the traditions of European Jews. But this didn't really fly with a lot of rabbis. There were plenty of rabbis who were still saying, we still have our authority as individuals. So what happened, and this was one of the kind of like splits that happened, was we hear of rabbis who completely submitted themselves, I mean, I'm not talking just in Europe, but everywhere, just completely submitted themselves to the Shulchan Aruch, which was very, very common in North Africa and the East. And when there are arguments about the fact that, for example, you barely hear about, we'll call them Sephardic rabbis, people barely know their writings, is because the moment they submitted to the Shulchan Aruch, their entire world of self-thinking and making conclusions by themselves died out. So when someone tells me, oh, there were plenty of rabbis who were writing in Iraq or Babylon or, you know, wherever, Syria or North Africa, I tell them, yeah, but they completely submitted to the Shulchan Aruch, which means they locked away their own minds. There's almost no original writing from that point on. So the last 500 years, there's been almost zero original thinking in the Sephardic world. In Europe, they went, no, we're not going to allow this. And this is why in Europe, for hundreds of years, and I'm not saying there are no books from the Sephardic world. There are, but their scope of original thinking is very limited, at least as far as I know. And I've been exposed to a lot of material. In Europe, they said, no, we're not going to give this up. And there were loads and loads of rabbis who continued writing their own opinions, and they might have submitted themselves a little bit to the Shulchan Aruch, but they, at the end of the day, they said, we still have our tradition of learning. So in Europe, it's split into two. You had the rabbis who were trying, or students of rabbis as well, who were trying to just focus on sharpening their minds and everything. And there were very, very active rabbis who continued studying the old way, maybe slightly less original, but still with a lot of original thinking and a lot of practical reality, and trying to study things as they are, studying the sources as they are. And at the same time, we also start hearing about the split between what's known as a Rosh Yeshiva, which is the head of a study school or a school, versus a Rav Moreh Hora'ah, a rabbi whose entire job is only to tell people what to do. So there are rabbis who are more we can call philosophers versus rabbis who are actual practical rabbis. That these are people who know what the halakha is. And that created a very, very interesting dynamic, and even to this very day, a very interesting dynamic with rabbis, that you have different types of rabbis. You have theoretical rabbis, and you have practical rabbis. And but the practical rabbis continued discussing things amongst themselves. The theoretical rabbis were more about giving, like, big speeches and explaining these complex things and everything, but there's no rabbi, is this kosher or not? They actually probably couldn't, in many cases, couldn't even answer that question unless it was very, very basic. And in this entire construct that was created, at the end of the day, the Shulchan Aruch did prevail. The Shulchan Aruch did, at the end of the day, set the tone to modern day Judaism. But even today, modern-day Judaism still struggles with this whole thing. And we're not done yet with the information, but I'm trying to give like an overall understanding of Judaism of today through a very specific historical occurrence. Now, I have to explain something. There's hundreds, if not thousands of people over hundreds of years. You can't cover every single thing.
Right.
So I'm picking like these points in history to point out. And the creation of the Shulchan Aruch was a real pivotal point in Jewish history, where most Sephardic rabbis, though they might write about their own traditions, like, for example, the Ben Ish Chai, who lived only about 150 years ago, or, other Sephardic rabbis that we hear of, they might talk about their traditions of the countries or even the cities they came from, but at the end of the day, the majority of their halakha is based on the Shulchan Aruch. But the Shulchan Aruch is an oxymoron, as I explained earlier, because he presumably tried to create unity, but then ignored many, many, many rabbis and many opinions, and he had to settle for a very specific handful of rabbis that he would write about. And, for example, the Balei HaTosafot, which we mentioned when we spoke about the time of Maimonides and Rashi and so on, they would have strongly objected to this entire thing because, in their opinion, you continue discussing directly from the Talmud. And there actually was a miniature rebellion that appeared in the 1700s against this ideology of the Shulchan Aruch, and a rebellion that, by the way, was revived about 200 years later with a group that I actually know very personally and very intimately because I actually was with them for a very, very long time.
Interesting.
But we're not going to go there yet because we're not going to go there today because this is a very, very complex thing. But we are kind of getting towards the end of the series because from the Shulchan Aruch onwards, there were plenty of rabbis you can talk about. And obviously between the Maimonides and the Shulchan Aruch, there were a lot of rabbis in between as well. But the creation of the Shulchan Aruch was a very, very pivotal point where suddenly there was this somewhat of a consensus that maybe we found this one book that we can all follow. And even if there are disagreements inside the book between the Rabbi Yosef Karo and the Rama, it's still one book, and we can all turn to this one book and say we agree with what he says here. But then on the other hand, we lose the creative ability of thought. We lose the creative ability of dealing with gray areas of halakha. We lose the sources that we work with, which means we're trying to limit ourselves again. If we had the freedom of knowledge, which was freedom of opinion amongst rabbis at the end of the Second Temple, going on many hundreds of years forward into the times of even the 10th century, where we hear about Rav Saadia Gaon, if you remember, that argued with Ben Meir over the calendar, and Ben Meir says to him, we actually cite the moon, and Rav Saadia Gaon goes like, what do you mean? Rav Saadia Gaon represents one of those first cases of trying to lock down opinions and say, this is the only thing you're allowed to follow. For me, Rav Saadia Gaon is like the first Orthodox Jew. And a very extreme example as well. He was very fierce about his opinions and what he believes, and this is why he became so aggressive when it comes to the Karaites. He's considered, amongst the Karaites, he was like number one enemy. He's, to this very day, he's labeled as one of the worst enemies the Karaite Judaism ever had.
Wow, okay.
And you hear a lot of, you hear a lot about rabbis' personal opinions throughout the centuries, and suddenly the Shulchan Aruch appears. And today, if anyone ever tries to practice something differently than the Shulchan Aruch, they're heavily criticized. But again, it's very theoretical. I always tell people, and this is something, I remember the first year of yeshiva. This was back in 2000. First year of yeshiva, I walk in, and one of my study partners is this wonderful, wonderful, sweet man who is Sephardic. I can't remember his name, but this was 16 years ago. Wonderful, sweet man, and we studied together, and we really enjoyed studying together. And when we sat down to decide what we're studying, he said to me, "You know what? We should study a certain book called the Mishnah Berurah, which has the Shulchan Aruch, but also the Ashkenaz tradition, because he's Sephardic, my family's from Europe, though we discovered we're probably Greek. It's another story by itself. Your humble host here is apparently not an Ashkenazi Jew. We're actually Mediterranean, which explains a lot of things about my family traditions and also how we look. My family are very dark people with black hair and dark eyes. So there's a lot of interesting history there that I can talk about next time, because it connects to the world of the yeshivot as well. Because I want to explain what that world really was really like. And so you make a note to yourself, this is what we're going to discuss next week.
You got it.
Or next time. And the interesting thing was that he was part of the yeshiva that was distinct from the rest of the yeshiva. There was the main study hall of the yeshiva, and then there was like the secondary study hall, which was for the more married and couples, you know, people who are, you know, they come in and they can't be there the entire day. Because when I went to yeshiva, it was 24/7. You wake up in the morning, you're in yeshiva, you go to sleep, you eat there, you sleep there, you do everything there. And you only go home every once in a while. Now, I at the time didn't have a home. I wouldn't say I was homeless, but I didn't really have a home because my parents already left the country and I was here by myself. So the yeshiva became my home. When everyone went home for Shabbat, I stayed in the yeshiva. So I had a special pass there to stay in the dormitory. And, they had other students who were, for example, American students. So there was always food there. So I would sit around with the American students, because also it was easier because I'm an English speaker. So it wasn't that problematic. And I would eat with them and hang out with them. There was even a point they wanted to put me in the American program, but they realized it wouldn't work. I'm Israeli. But the thing was that we were studying this, and I remember we were having these discussions with Shulchan Aruch. Says, "Oh, we only follow Shulchan Aruch." But when I actually saw his practices, I point out that's not according to Shulchan Aruch. That's not according to Shulchan Aruch. That's not according to Shulchan Aruch. But you have these groups that talk about we only follow Shulchan Aruch, but they don't really. So there's this place inside modern day Judaism where there are certain ideals that you hear people talk about, but they're not necessarily real. They're not really living by it. So I think there is to some degree this false, not in a negative way, in kind of like a very neutral way, but a false feeling of unity, really continuing what was done much earlier, which was the right of the individual opinion. Also because things change all the time. The Shulchan Aruch was written 500 years ago. It doesn't answer questions that we have today. Things that are things that he couldn't record. You know, he doesn't give you with the Shulchan Aruch an appendix with all the court rulings that he might have had that might shed some light on what we do today. You still go in front of a rabbi, and a rabbi still needs to present his own opinion about what to do. It's just the mechanisms he uses are different. He would reference the Shulchan Aruch as a very, very heavy anchor, but he still has the wind, which is his, as he used, the metaphor he used, that kind of guides him in other areas or other pieces of information that will help him make come to a conclusion. But the principle of unity became very, very important to a lot of rabbis, and a lot of rabbis gave up. In other words, the Maharal and the Maharshal lost the battle over the opinion of what Torah study should be like. And it's very interesting that today you can walk into a synagogue and there are people who come from different places, and there is still a very, very strong sense of unity. Even if people practice things a little differently, there's no feeling as if they're battling against one another or there's a struggle or anything. So the Yosef Kalo somewhat succeeded, in his attempt to create unity. But the price is losing ancient traditions and losing the right of thought, which paved the way to what we know today as orthodoxy. Hmm. And orthodoxy is a very, very interesting phenomenon that happened in Judaism. And when people talk about orthodoxy today, a lot of Orthodox Jews believe that orthodoxy has always existed. And that's a falsehood. Jews in Europe and North Africa or wherever were not what people think are. There's this narrative. It's a term we use in history, in study of history. There's a narrative as if orthodoxy has always existed. The same way there's a narrative as if there's an unbroken chain of knowledge and Torah practice from times of Moses, where there is not, which is one of the points that we pointed out in the first couple of recordings.
And I have to say, Yoel, it seems like a pretty good place to stop at this point. You know, there's been a lot of information we've covered over the last year and a half. I think it's been pretty close, 19 plus months. Well, I don't think it's 19 months, 19 no, programs, probably over 12 and a half months.
No, I don't think we've even been doing this for a year. It should be, we started doing this program
after the last Torah cycle.
After the last Torah cycle, so we're only some like seven
seems
or eight.
Seems like
eight
years,
in,
man.
So.
No.
There's a lot of information.
There's a ton of information.
And we did go over a very, very, very long. I mean, we're sitting now somewhere around the 1600s, 1700s, but we started somewhere around the year 1400 BC. So think about it.
Oh yeah, just a ton of information. So, but we're starting to get into the more pragmatic aspects of Torah today, how we deal with it today. And I really am excited about what you've just said concerning the rabbi was kind of this half Pharisee wannabe kind of guy who just came out of the woodwork, at least as much as in as much likelihood he came out of the woodwork as he came out of Pharisaic Judaism, and that's kind of what we're seeing today, that there's an awful lot of people that aren't following, you know, the generally accepted orthodoxy, and they're operating outside of that, and you know, it's interesting that we see this recurring cycle.
Exactly, and today there's an ongoing battle over Jewish identity. I'm thinking you're referring to a Reformed rabbi, specifically a Reformed rabbi that I heard a couple of days ago. It was just ridiculous. I mean, I'm listening to this person speak, and he talks about in our tradition, what tradition? You know, it'll be amazing if you don't eat pork. You know, this is kind of like the stuff that I sometimes have to deal with people, you know, reinterpreting Torah. You know, I don't believe that my God would want that. It's black on white in the biblical text. You can't argue with that.
Right.
Or I remember I once had an argument with, if I can do a in memoriam here for a second, my wife's grandmother passed away 10 years ago. She passed away on the eve of Shavuot, which was literally just a couple days ago. Was the last Shabbat, so I don't know when people will hear this recording, but the Shabbat before Shavuot was 10 years, a decade to her passing. She was a very colorful person. She survived, her family survived the Holocaust. She grew up in the United States. She moved there as a child. And she died, I think she was 74 when she passed away. And her family survived the Holocaust, and she grew up in like American Judaism of say the 1950s, 1960s, where there was the Reform movement, but they were still keeping a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And today the Reform movement is completely, Reform and conservative are completely haywire. They've lost sometimes even every moral compass. Especially in the Reform movement, there's like liberal Judaism and stuff like that, humanism, and it's really, things which, some of the humanism, yeah, I agree, let's be nice to one another, but it goes beyond that scope. And so when she moved to Israel, somewhere in the early 90s, I think it was, or the late 80s, they retired and everything, she stayed in contact, or she came in contact with the conservative and reform movement in Israel, because this is what she knew in the United States. So she stayed there. She became very Orthodox as well. And I remember in her funeral, we had a problem. There weren't enough people. Hmm. There were elderly couple that moved to Israel, and they hung around in very specific circles. They didn't have childhood friends or even adult friends that they were elderly, and they didn't really move around that much. And when she passed away, many of the friends and family lived in the United States, and not everyone could get on a plane and come out. So we were standing there, and someone wanted to say Kaddish. So in the funeral home itself, there were loads and loads of people. In the funeral itself, there were enough people, because if you don't have enough people, the Chevra Kadisha, this is one of the things they do. If you don't have enough people funeral, they will organize people.
Hmm.
They will make sure that there's at least 10 men there. But then we had a memorial service. I think it wasn't the funeral that we had the problem. It was later on. It was when when we had the tombstone set in. So usually you go and you have a service there. And they wouldn't have enough people to say a Kaddish. So we're standing there. And there was this really, really sweet man who was a conservative rabbi. Really, very sweet man. I mean, I like him. And we became friends. To be very, very clear, we became friends. But he wanted to say Kaddish. And the Kaddish, which is what's usually known as the mourner's prayer, you can't say it if you don't have 10 people, or 10, specifically 10 men. But we didn't even have 10 people.
Mm.
I mean, I would have even said, there's some women here. We maybe, I might have even showed some very extreme leniency there to say, okay, we can say even by adding the women, if I would have taken that approach, though most of the people there were Orthodox, and obviously I wouldn't do it either. I just said it was like, to show him some kind of leniency towards this rabbi, I would have said, maybe you can say even by adding the women. So you said, oh, we can just add their 10 people somewhere in the radius of a kilometer.
There you go.
And I looked at him and I'm like, are you kidding me? But that's kind of basically what we deal with. There are no rules. They're making things up as they go. There has to be some kind of an anchor somewhere. You can have you go back to the early rabbis. They had their opinion, but there was an anchor. They didn't work out of thin air. And what I see with a lot of conservative and reformed teachers or rabbis or community leaders is that they literally make things up as they go.
Mm.
So when I heard this rabbi saying, the so-called rabbi saying, our traditions, I'm like, who are you kidding? You're reinventing. Every morning you wake up, you're reinventing something. And I've literally seen with my own eyes a conservative rabbi every 10, 15 minutes coming up with a new thing. We were in a discussion, and we spoke for about an hour, and he literally, throughout the entire discussion, about four or five times, he reinvented the wheel to fit whatever situation he was trying to deal with. No anchor at all. This was like, using some other principle to try to deal with Judaism. So you turn around to God and say, you wrote here a Torah or something? I think you should reconsider that. That's kind of the mentality I get out of it. My God wouldn't say that. Well, who says that you represent God in any form, shape, or way? So that's the thing. The only place that we can accept other opinions if it's anchored in something. And that was the thing. That was the mechanism they were using. So you can have authority comes from an anchor, not because you suddenly one day are a self-proclaimed teacher. It comes from an anchor from somewhere.
Right.
So when people ask me, you know, why I can say certain things about Judaism and history and everything, because I actually have anchors. I belong to this unbroken chain of teachers for the last 1,500 years to 2,000 years of Judaism, that maybe I never went to become ordained and things like that, but I could have. And there was the possibility. I was actually offered to go to rabbinic school several times. And I just said, I don't see myself as a rabbi. And my rabbi, when I used to have discussions with him, halachic discussions, my rabbi will talk about the school of thought my rabbi comes from. He would never just give me a yes, no answer. He would never pull a shulchan aloch on me.
Uh-huh.
Every time I would ask him a question, he wouldn't tell me, oh, this just says this. He would actually have a discussion, and we would go back and forth until we conclude something which is acceptable to both of us. That's the type of school I came from. That's the type of studying
nice.
I came from. And that's the type of studying I hold to this very day. So am I a heretic, or am I really a person who's continuing the real old traditions of Judaism? And I think I'm the latter. I am more rooted in the real knowledge of Judaism, probably many rabbis. And I'm not boasting here. It's just a fact. And because I learned from very specific authorities that are, by the way, very important. My rabbi was commonly in the chambers of a rabbi of the yeshiv, who was one of the greatest rabbis in Jerusalem the last 90 years, about 80 years. Say. So this is I come from a very, very, very important place with the knowledge that I have. And I'm very proud of it as well. It's just I'm very careful.
Well, you
I
ought
don't
to be.
Say I'm,
and not everybody gets that opportunity.
But I don't say I'm a rabbi. I don't say that I'm authority of any sort. People ask me questions in halakha, I refuse to answer. I tell them there's a rabbi, here's his phone number, go ask him.
Right.
I have friends. I have very, very sweet friends who keep on asking me questions in halakha, and I never answer. I tell them, you know, go ask Rabbi so-and-so, or if there's a specific rabbi I know is an expert in certain area, go ask him. Yes, I know what the answer is. I'm not an authority. I can't. I'm very, very careful with that.
Yeah, safer that way.
I don't know if safer is the right word. It's just, I think that's a truthfulness. I never received the ordination to be a person who gives an answer. I can reference you, I can send you, I can give you hints to where what the answer might be, but I cannot undermine people who are the people who do these types of things.
Right.
You ask me questions in academics, easy. That I do have authority in because I am trained in that. But when it comes to rabbinic information, I can only give you an overall idea, I can only give you references. I do not give answers.
Yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful.
And people send me emails with questions, and keep on telling them, don't ask me.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's easier. It's provable to operate within a historical grammatical context. When you work within a religious perspective, then you have to be authorized to speak on behalf of the religious perspective. So you actually are training in the historical grammatical context. So that's the place you feel most comfortable. I completely agree with you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I might one day, there was this joke going on in my family, that I might one day go in the footsteps of my father and become a rabbi, but I'm very doubtful of that.
Well, you're young,
But yeah, and I know plenty of rabbis. If I ever have a question, I know who to turn around to and say, okay, rabbi, someone asked me this question, here are the details, what do I tell them? I've done that a couple of times, but I usually tell people, listen, you need to find a rabbi you're comfortable with, and ask the question. This is the thing. There are a lot of people who are very concerned, you know, a lot of people who are very into Judaism and rabbinic Judaism were very confused about my approach about things. And then there are people who are against rabbinic Judaism that kept on using me as some type of like a flag or something to prove their opinion. And people need to understand, at the end of the day, I'm not here nor there. I have my opinion about certain things. It's my opinion. But at the end of the day, I don't tell you what to do. I don't tell you what to think. I'm only presenting information, and you know, you do with it whatever you want. But don't misquote me. Don't say Yoel said such and such. No,
exactly.
It's the difference. You know, in academics, a lot of the things that we talk about are 100% theoretical. So when I say here, yes, there is a difference between what people did back then and what people do today. True. The question is that really a problem? And that's the real question that needs to be asked. And not, look, I found this, I found that. I did that many times with rabbis. I said, yeah, but I found that in the traditions of Ashkenaz, in the book of such and such, this is what they originally did. And my rabbi looked at me and said, you know what? Here's a trick. He pulled out even an older book and showed me what they did back then, which was different than what the book I pulled out. So I learned a lesson there of like, you know, you find something, be very careful what you do with it.
70 faces of Torah.
Or just, you know, things change.
Yeah.
And it's okay.
I like that. Well, Yoel, thank you very much. Really great information again today. I hope you guys enjoyed it, folks. If you have any questions, please get a hold of Yoel. Yoel, go ahead and give us, it's been a couple weeks for people, go ahead and give us your email address.
Okay, so my email address is HebrewInIsrael, one word, at gmail.com. That's one thing. Then there's the Facebook page, which is, again, Hebrew in Israel. And now these days it has a picture of me, so you don't confuse it with someone else. I had a lot of people write to me, so Nehemiah, what do you think? I'm like, I'm not Nehemiah. or some other teacher. There were several names that kept on popping up. So at one point I put up Hebrew in Israel with Yoel Halevi in big words and also my picture that people can know who I am. And you can also, you know, you can also go to my
webs. I don't know how they get confuse you with Nehemiah.
I have hair. I am darker than Nehemiah. And I have, and my hair is black. Blackish, very dark brown or black. You can also go to my website, which is again, Hebrew in Israel, dot something. It used to be .wix.com, and I keep on forgetting.
.net,
I think it's .net now. It's HebrewInIsrael.net. I changed it a while back, and I keep on forgetting what it was. You can go there, and there are a lot of the older recordings that I've done with myself or with others, and including this series, are going to be featured there. My series on the Torah that I did. Not with you, not on Talking Torah, but the things that I did are either in YouTube or in SoundCloud. But on the website, you can, for example, comment on things that I write. There are little articles about Hebrew or history or biblical studies that I put up every couple of weeks. Because a lot of the pressure of what I have to do with work and studies, I originally wanted to produce an article every week, and I just can't do it physically. There's also a donation button there if you're interested to help out. Usually donations go to help get a hold of material, because some material, anyone who's been a student before or does research knows that some of these books are very expensive, painfully expensive. I have some books here which cost hundreds of dollars as well, which is a nightmare. But they're essential for some of my work, so I coughed up the money and did it. So you can do that basically by doing that, you're directly contributing to helping others.
Yep.
And, you know, the website is very simple setting. It's very difficult to get lost there. I did deliberately, it's simple and it's deliberately like that. But obviously if you ever find spelling mistakes or anything, don't be afraid to comment and tell me, oh, I found this, you know, it helps me out. It makes the website look more professional.
Even though your English is extremely fluent, you know, there are things on your writing that sometimes shows that you're not necessarily first language with English.
Yeah, or that the grammar is actually English grammar versus American grammar. I actually had that quite a few times.
Oh, that's true too.
But again, if you ever find mistakes, I mean, I'm very open to hearing corrections. The only thing is, be respectful in the way you write.
Oh, yes.
And don't preach to me. You preach to me, I won't listen. It's just, that's the fact. I don't believe that people have absolute knowledge. There's a very interesting ancient Egyptian proverb. There is no man who is born wise. In other words, what they meant there is that there is no man who is born with all the knowledge and everything. You develop your knowledge and you learn from others, and that's how you become wise.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, or folks, you can get hold of me at jeff@talkingtorah.org.
Who wants to get a hold of you?
There's always this, the odd person who says, who's this guy? So anyhow, folks, thank you very much. I will talk to you guys.
How to contact Jeff? How do I find this guy called Jeff Gilbert?
Who's this guy, Jeff? What is this guy, Jeff? Jeff@talkingtorah.org. So with that, we'll see you guys next week. Shalom.
Talking Torah.